So today, the Chula Satchaka Sutta, the smaller discourse to Satchaka, reports the Buddha replying to a challenge by the debater Satchaka by expounding the selfless nature of the five aggregates. This discourse has two Chinese parallels found in the Sanyutta Agama, no doubt in the Kanda Sanyutta, and in the Ekotara Agama also, possibly in the fives, but all of them place the discourse at Vaisali. Okay. And Satchaka, of course, being a Jain and Nigantha, and a Jain layman, and according to the Pali Dictionary proper names, he's addressed as Agivesana, this is Gotta name. So this is the Sanskrit version of Agnivesyayanas. This means something like the servants of the sacred fire. Something like that. Buddhaghosa says in the commentary that both his parents were Nigantas, skilled debaters who married at the suggestion of the Lichavis because they were unable to defeat each other in argument. Sounds a little bit implausible, but it may be a representative of their perception of marital bliss. Two people who can't defeat each other in argument, I don't know. The Lichavis provided for their maintenance. Four daughters were born to them, Satcha, Lola, Patachara, of course is well known, and Sivavatika. Satcha being, of course, truth, as in Satchaka.
I would have sworn this was a man.
Who?
Satchaka.
He is.
Well, he's a girl, four daughters.
Yeah, his daughter is a girl, yes. Oh, sorry, no. So you're right. No, these are the daughters, right? Of the parents. That's right. But then Satchaka was their brother, one brother and four sisters. Right.
Is that Padachara? Is that the Padachara?
I think so. Yeah, the Padachara. Lola is Lola's definitely a girl. Okay. So anyway, the girls all got beaten by Sariputta in debate and became arahants. And Satchaka was their brother, was the youngest of them. And it said that later, so this is, it's a little bit unusual in that he was sort of, seems to have been persuaded by the Buddha and so on, but there's no talk of his attainment. Although we'll see that there's some differences in the different versions here. But it says that long after the Buddha's death, he was reborn in Ceylon as the Terakala Buddha Rakita and attained arahantship there. So this is the tradition. So how much of that is true is difficult to say. But one thing which is probably true, because all the different versions agree that he was in Vaisali, and Vaisali is actually the home of Nigantanatha Buddha. So the Jains, actually the homeland of their religion is Vaisali, just as for Buddhism it was Kapilavastu in the Sakyan Republic. And actually, of course, Nigantanatha Buddha and the Buddha had very similar lives in many ways, both from a kind of similar kind of upper class background in a republican society and so on and so forth. So many similarities, so it's not at all surprising that there should have been strong lay support for Nigantanatha Buddha in Vaisali. Now, that's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Vaisali in the great wood in the hall with a peaked roof. Now, on that occasion, Satchaka, the Niganta's son, was staying at Vaisali, a debater and a clever speaker, regarded by many as a saint. Okay? He was by many as a saint. Sadhu Samato. Sadhu. Regarded as Sadhu Samato. Now, he was making this statement before the Vaisali assembly. I see no recluse or Brahman, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, even one claiming to be an accomplished and fully enlightened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble, and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in a debate with me. Even if I were to engage a senseless post in debate, he would shake, shiver, and tremble. What shall I say of a human being? So, he's got a healthy kind of sense of confidence, yeah, that's right. Even the Arahant, okay, na Sankampeya, shaking, and Sankampeya, na Sampavede, shaking, trembling. Yasa Kachehi, he's one of Eva's Ehis. That's right, it's an Ehi, and this time means from the armpits. As in ablative, flowing, sweat flowing from the armpits, okay? So this class, I guess we will have to choose another grammatical case to focus on. We've had the nominative and the accusative. And so in order to, we've talked a bit about verbs previously. So to...
And locative, we've had locative.
Only casually, we haven't had a proper thing. But now to get a sentence to happening, let's focus on simple verbs for this class, and on the simple present tense verbs. And so I'll point these simple verb forms out as we go along, okay? Some of them, not all of them, because there's too many to point out, but just so that we recognize them. So in our first sentence, the Blessed One, in nominative, okay, was dwelling at Vaisali, and dwelling is the verb, viharati, okay? And so, of course, this is a very common verb we found in virtually every sutta, probably absolutely every sutta. One of the most common verbs, viharati, singular, one dwells, or he dwells, present tense. So these verb forms with the ati at the end is the third person singular present tense verb. Okay? And we find them very commonly. No, this means is dwelling. It's a historical present. Okay? Even though it's used in the past tense, and it's mixed up with past tense verbs, but actually this verb itself is a present tense verb. Okay?
So it's dwelling then, not one dwells.
It depends how you want to say. He dwells, yeah. How would you say it? How do you usually present it in English? You say one dwells, I guess. Yeah, he one dwells, yeah. Is dwelling would be the present participle, which is a slightly different form, yeah. So he viharati and evang vachang bahasati. Okay? So again, this sentence here, so... It's a nominative, so it's the subject of the sentence. He spoke these words or this statement. Okay, evang vachang in accusative. Okay, he spoke nominative, the verb, and the accusative, bhasati. Except he speaks, it's actually present tense.
The accusative is the object, right?
The accusative here is the object, yeah.
Well, is it an accusative sometimes an object?
Accusative isn't always the object, no. It can play different functions in a sentence.
Then how do you know?
You just have to keep on learning, that's all. Figure it out. The most common usage is as an object, okay? But not always. Okay, so seda, the word for sweat. Seda, okay, mutayong, okay, and then this little idiom at the end, which also is nice to note, kopanavado manusa bhutasa, and this little idiom, so the manusa bhutasa is a human being, okay, but this little idiom here is what to speak of, so vado is to speak, ko is who, literally who or what or something, pana is something like but. Okay, and so this is a little idiom that means, and so what to speak of a human being, you know. I could even make a senseless post shiver and tremble, what to speak of a human being, yeah. Quite nice.
If Seda is sweat and Kachehi is from the armpit, what's the verb?
The verb literally is to let go, to release.
The sweat.
Yep. All right. Now, then when it was morning, Venerable Asaji, of course, Asaji being one of the first five disciples, became an arahant listening to the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which may or may not be significant, since we've got a sutta very much like the Anattalakkhana Sutta here being presented, so that may or may not be significant. it's interesting that if we look at the dating of this particular sutta, later on the Buddha refers to King Ajatasattu, and as I've pointed out earlier, that the presence of King Ajatasattu was probably only king for the last few years of the Buddha's life, certainly not more than 10 years. So it must have been in the last period, and so Asaji, even though he was the earliest disciple, still figures here. He doesn't turn up all that often.
Only because the first five disciples don't get too much mention.
Right? They don't at all. Nor do the Yasa and all his friends, and nor do the monks who the Buddha encountered, the ones who were looking for the prostitute, nor do the 1,000 Kassapa fire worshipping ascetics. Yeah, all of those first disciples are very, very quiet. Occasionally, like here, you might have one of them turn up. But the first ones who ordained, who are actually featured prominently, of course, is Sariputra Moggallana. Yeah, which is quite interesting. And I wonder whether, I've never heard any explanation for that, but I wonder whether it's because those early disciples were, I was thinking about this in the context of Bhikkhuni ordination some time ago, but the early disciples were mostly converted from other sects. Right? And So perhaps simply they may have had very reclusive tendencies. I mean, not all of them were, but the majority were just converted from other sects. So maybe they just had very reclusive tendencies and they didn't take a big part in the active management and running of the Sangha, which is why they didn't show up, didn't appear so often. But that also applies to other monks like Anuruddha and Mahakasapa and so on. Perhaps, yeah, difficult to say.
In common sense. A kind of intuitive from your applying general experience of what's reasonable.
Yeah.
What all that was saying.
Yeah. It's very, very problematic because it is all of these kind of things, and you encounter some kind of variation. Do you say it must be wrong because it's different from the majority of them, or is it? Have they been standardized and all of these things? Very, very, very difficult. So we just have to be very. I think these days there's much more modesty, much more humility in the way that scholars approach texts. That we're not so confident that we can find the original text or that there is an original text. And I think some scholars have taken that to the extreme of saying, well, it's a load of rubbish and you shouldn't even bother wasting your time with it, which I think is an overreaction. But I think there are certain kinds of things. It's what we see with these studies, with what Venerable Anadio finds, is that, you know, there's a degree, there's a spectrum, and sometimes you just have to say, well, I don't really know. Sometimes you say, well, it seems this is more likely. In other cases, you can be fairly confident. And so, you know, by assessing things in different ways, you can solve certain kinds of problems, as long as you don't think you can solve every problem, but you can solve certain kinds of problems. Okay, now Venerable Tapasi has substantially extended the sutta class by asking a question about something which is quite a difficult little matter. Let me just find one sutta.
Why are sankharas, anicca, and dharmas, dharma, and anatta, and what's the difference between sankhara and dharma?
Yeah.
Why are they the upper round, or why aren't they both impermanent? Why aren't they both inevitable? Why aren't they both not
in the sansa? Right. So, to investigate that, let's have a look at this little sutta from the Anguttara. And Anguttara 3 is a very famous sutta, found similar forms of this sutta, or variations are found in a number of different contexts. But we'll just have a look at this as a context here that talks about sankhara, sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, and sabbe dhamma anatta. And this is one of the classic contexts that this thing appears in, okay? Upadava bhikkhave tathagatanang anupadava tathagatanang. Upada, arising. Whether there is the arising of the tathagatas or not, or no arising of tathagatas, pitava sadhatu, that dhatu, okay, principle, element, remains, tita, okay, is steady, stands, okay, like Nigatanata Putta in the statues, just stays there, right? Dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata. So these synonyms, the dhamma here meaning principle, titta, standing, this is an abstractive ending. So the standingness of dhamma, okay, steadiness of dhamma, stability of dhamma. Dhamma niyamata, niyama is a natural law, okay. So the niyamata, again, the natural principles of dhamma, something like that. Okay, so this is dhamma as a natural law. Sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are impermanent. That the Tathagata abhisambuddhati abhisameti, he awakens to and penetrates to. Abhisambuddhitva abhisametva, having awakened and penetrated to it, he declares it, he teaches it, deseti, panyapeti, makes it known, pattapeti, establishes it, vivarati, discloses it, vibhajati, analyzes it, utani karoti, and makes it clear, sabbe sankhara anicchati. So this is a very, very important philosophical statement. Whether the Buddha's around or not doesn't make any difference. Things are always impermanent, right? He doesn't make impermanence. He's not the creator of impermanence. He realizes it, and then having realized it, he teaches it, okay? So this is, but the impermanence itself is a natural principle. Same thing for sabbe sankhara dukkha, and same for sabbe dhamma anatta. And then the question arises, of course, is why is there the difference in formulation between sabbe sankhara in the first two and sabbe dhamma in the third one? And this is a question which has vexed and worried the interpreters and commentators for 2,500 years. And some say, so we could have a cascade of potential explanations here. Some say that the Dhamma here is Nibbana. Okay? So the Dhamma means all sankharas plus the unconditioned Nibbana, which is not self. So you can't say that Nibbana is impermanent. You can't say that Nibbana is dukkha, but you can say that Nibbana is anatta. This is according to the arguments of certain monks. For example, Venerable Nyanaponika made this argument. Again, political. He made this argument to respond to the self-theorists led by Carolyn Rice Davies of the Pali Text Society, who were trying to argue that the Buddha was a closet Upanishadic teacher who was teaching the big self. And so he wanted to prove that nothing, it was that Nibbana was not self. And strangely enough, there's no actual statement deciding that question in the canon itself in a direct way. And so Nyanaponika interpreted this passage to say, Nyanaponika and others, interpreted this passage to say all dhammas are not self, meaning Nibbana is also not self, which seems quite a plausible explanation. The problem with it, as was pointed out many years ago by Venerable Kheminda Thera, is that this kind of contemplation, elsewhere it said that, you know, contemplating in this one is revulsed and repulse and turns away from all dhammas, yeah? And then turning away from all dhammas, then you attain peace and so on and so forth. So obviously, it can't mean getting revulsed and turning away from Nibbana, one would hope. So that explanation doesn't seem to work. The commentaries themselves give different explanations. One of them is that it involves this kind of weird idea, which is actually not, it's kind of incipient Platonism in this kind of thing, but they had this idea that panyatis, or concepts, are not conditioned. So the conditioned is all real things, but concepts are not conditioned.
It's done work for me.
Because it's a kind of, but you can think of it in terms of like a name, yeah. So a person changes all their life, but their name doesn't change, yeah. So in that sense, it's a bit of a complex kind of philosophical kind of thingamy thingle. But anyway, this is how they interpret it. So this is another explanation. However, I think they're all wrong. And I think I can give a better explanation based on this sutta, which is that if you have a look at this sutta, obviously there's a bit of a tension going on here. The Buddha is saying that this Dhamma, there's Dhamma here. You know, let's look at the way that, if we want to say why is there a difference in the way that Dhamma is used here, let's have a look at what Dhamma actually means in this context, rather than inventing the idea that Dhamma means Nibbana or that it means Panyatis or something like that. What does it actually mean in the context that we're talking about? In this context, Dhamma means something like a natural principle, okay? And that natural principle remains, okay? It's steady, okay? So that what that means, in the past everything was impermanent, now everything is impermanent, and in the future everything will be impermanent. Yeah? So this is what that means. And so dhammas, of course, are impermanent, like the actual phenomena, stuff, is impermanent, but the principles are permanent. It's very similar to the way that we would think of, say, the laws of physics working, you know, if I drop something down, then that the falling of that thing is impermanent, but the law of gravity is more or less permanent. Whether it actually is or not is another matter, but it's that similar kind of distinction. And so this Dhamma this Dhamma is like a description of how things behave or how things appear, and they always appear in the same way. Okay? So this is why I think in this initial one, sabbe sankhara anicchati. Because the Dhamma isn't anicca in the same way. Now that's not to say that the Dhamma is nicca, okay, which would be to assert that it's an actual permanently existing thing, okay? But it's not appropriate to describe it as anicca. Okay? And that's the whole point of this thing. It's saying, you know, in past Buddha eras, in this Buddha eras, in the future Buddha, whether there's a Buddha around or not, the Dhamma is still the same. Okay? It's all impermanent. So this is why I think that that's what Dhamma, the difference here with Dhamma in this last one, of course, is that Dhamma here could be understood in both contexts, both as the phenomena of existence, consciousness and physical phenomena and so on, these are certainly not self, but also the laws or the laws, but the panyatis, the descriptions of these things in terms of dependent origination, the three characteristics and so on, the Four Noble Truths, these are also not self, okay? So you can't say that, for example, impermanence is impermanent. Right, this would be an instance of Gödel's law, yeah, because if you say everything's impermanent is itself impermanent, that would mean impermanence would have to come to an end, and so permanent there'd have to be something permanent, yeah.
That's why the Buddha said it's conditional. All conditional phenomena is impermanent. Not all things are impermanent.
Right.
So just the fundamental things like Dhamma or the law of Dhamma itself is a permanent thing, but it's not conditional.
Yeah,
it's not a conditioned formation.
I wouldn't say it's a permanent thing, but yeah, it's hard to say it. That's why the Buddha kind of sneaks around it and tries not to commit himself by actually saying it is a permanent thing, because this of course is exactly what the Sarvastivadins did, is they then inferred from the permanence of the Dhamma to the permanence of all the Dhammas, the individual Dhammas. Okay, so this is what they said, that the Dhammas exist in the past, present, and future, and they almost certainly they inferred that idea from contexts like this one.
Are you saying that the Dhamma is titta, stable? But
yeah.
Stable doesn't mean permanent. Just like you were saying about the speed of light, that the speed of light actually can change, or something you were saying.
Yeah, it seems to be. Yeah,
can actually change, and the laws of physics actually can change.
It seems, but that's how some argue. Yeah, which, yeah.
And what about in the sutra we're looking at, the sankhara as in the sankhara in the five aggregates, and the sankhara as in the sambhaya sankhara. What is the difference there?
Well, again, these things are never, these particular phrases are never actually explicitly spelled out in the suttas. Okay, so one could have different interpretations. The usual interpretation is that sabbe sankhara in these contexts means all the whole five khandhas.
As in the five khandhas of an individual, you mean?
Could be external as well, yeah.
And what about the sankhara in dependent origination?
Sankhara in dependent origination is the same as in the fourth of the five khandhas, it's intention.
But sankhara comes from the word...
Isn't it sankhara mental formation, not just volition, but all mental formation?
In the suttas it's defined specifically as intention, both in dependent origination and in the five khandhas. Although normally it's explained as being broader than that, but that's literally how it's defined, both in the Khanda Sanyutta and Nidana Sanyutta.
And Sankara, you said kara, which means to create.
Yeah.
So whatever is created or is in...
Yeah. Everything conditioned.
Everything conditioned.
Yeah.
So karma producing thought.
Something like that.
Because if it's not karma producing, it could be, for example, like an arahant, and they don't produce karma producing thought or action.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, does that, what do you reckon? Does that make sense?
Still not sure about Dhamma.
Dhammas are not self.
In the sense of, what does it mean? Yeah.
Like the category, is that what you're talking about? What category it falls into?
So I guess what you're saying is that the Sankhara is in the volitional formations, or that they... Just created things, all conditioned things are impermanent.
Yeah.
But the Dhamma is something that you could say the laws of Dhamma are stable.
Yep.
But you couldn't say that they're impermanent, nor could you say that they're permanent.
Mm.
However, they are not self.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Whether you could or couldn't say that they're impermanent, but they're permanent, but you know the Buddha doesn't quite say that they're permanent. But it's very close. These words that he's using here, tirata and things, these normally would be synonyms or virtually synonyms for saying it is permanent. It's very similar, but he's not quite saying that. Yeah, it's a very subtle usage of language.
So how would you translate Dhamma there?
Principles.
Principles.
Yeah.
Would it not be similar to saying that E equals MC square is actually a principle?
Yeah.
It's not permanent, like, show me an E equals MC squared.
Yeah.
You can't show me an E equals MC squared. It's just a principle, like Dhamma is merely a principle.
Yeah.
But it is an occurrence which occurs all the time.
Yep.
It takes place as a principle all the time.
Yeah. It helps to understand these things as being panyatis or descriptions. Yeah. So E equals MC squared is not something which exists in the universe governing the speed of light. Yeah. It's a generalization which is inferred from observing how light actually behaves. Yeah? And so the same thing with impermanence. It's impermanent. The impermanence of things is not something which actually exists in the world. It's just that if you look at how things actually are, you say, oh, this is impermanent, that's impermanent, that's impermanent, that's impermanent. Well, then you make an inductive generalization, and you say, oh, actually, all things are impermanent. Yeah? So it's actually an inductive generalization. So in that sense, it's...
And you could say for all time...
For all time, it's a change.
Is irrelevant.
Yeah.
If it was not disproved.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just on principle, it is true. And for all time, as far as there is a universe is concerned, there's light and matter, then that equation holds. It's not going to change.
Right.
So in that matter, you could say it's permanent. But it's only the principle which is permanent.
Yep.
It's not a... conditioned phenomena, which
kind of thing
is
impermanent.
Yep. On a practical level, when we're practicing this or when we're contemplating it, then how should we apply it? The sabbe sankhara and the sabbe dhamma.
The practical thing is to realize this difference that we've mentioned a few times in the talks is that there's this distinction between directly seeing something and then an inference based on that thing, okay? And so what you can actually see is something impermanenting itself, if you like, right? So you can actually see the ending of things. Actually, you can't even see that, actually. You can't even see a thing in being impermanent. You can either see that it's there or it's not there, right? But you can't actually... It's either there or it isn't there, yeah? Or it's in the process of becoming one to the other, yeah? But if you can see that it's there at one stage, you can't see the impermanence of it, can you? Because it's there, yeah? And you can't see when it's gone, you can't see the impermanence of it because it's not there, right? You can't see the fact that it used to be there, right? If an elephant walks into the room...
And then it's not there.
You can see the fact that there's an elephant there. Well, the elephant walks out of the room. You can see the fact that there's an elephant not in the room.
That's from
you see the change, though. You do. You direct experience. So when the breath comes and ends, that ending, you see. I mean, experience it. And you see it.
Lies upon a deductive knowledge from 2 points.
It's not like you're conceiving it. You're being touched by it on an awareness level. It's there, it rises, and then it goes, and it imprints the mind that it's been and that it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. It imprints the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah? So there's memory is there.
There's knowing.
But there's memory as well.
Memory and knowing.
Yeah, because the time when it's not there.
Yes. Right. But you're watching it.
Yeah.
Watching it disappear.
Yeah.
See it go.
Yeah.
Fainter.
And then it's gone. Yeah. And so, exactly. So memory is involved in that process. So, because memory is one that can then look at that. Okay. So it knows, oh, there was an elephant and now it's gone and so on. Yeah. So it makes it possible to know in that way. And so memory. And so then, on being able to see, in over and over and over again, the same thing. This is how inductive generalization works. You see many, many, many times, and then it hits you. Oh, okay, that's what all sankharas. See, as long as you're seeing individual sankharas are impermanent, right? This is the problem. Anyone can see individual sankharas are impermanent. Everyone sees that all the time, okay? But you don't understand, well, that's actually the same for all of them. So you keep on trying to escape from one problem by trying to get another problem. You know, it's this kind of classic kind of avoidance thing. I'm going to choose the low-fat food, and I'm going to say, this is good for me. I'm going to escape the dukkha of having lots of fat, but of course they put twice as much sugar in it. And I'm going to get the one with low sugar in it, but of course it's got twice as much fat in it. I've got one with low fat and sugar, but then it's got twice as much salt in it, you know, and MSG. Yeah, and so you're always bodging around with that kind of thing. So you can see this thing, but then you have to make this sort of a generalization. You realize, oh, okay, you know, all of it is like that. Yeah, and so that's when you can actually get dispassionate towards all sankharas. Otherwise, you can't get dispassionate towards all sankharas unless you can say all sankharas are impermanent. You can't get dispassionate towards all sankharas. Yeah, but you can't see all sankharas. You can only see this sankhara which is in front of me right now, yeah? So how do we become dispassionate to all sankharas? Well, obviously through a process of generalization.
Okay, can I... from my experience, it's not... I don't feel like I'm generalizing. I'm feeling like you watch the breath, it goes, the out-breath goes, and you're more in the breath going, leading into the nothingness, to the space before the new breath goes, and the mind keeps going more and more into that disappearing. And so it's not when you see the anicca and the emptiness of it, it doesn't feel like I'm generalizing. It feels like underneath it, where it's like the mind just suddenly opens its eyes to that disappearance all the time. You know, and in that mind opening, like your eyes, oh my God, that's then something changes because you've really seen it. So when you talk about, you know, using a generalization, how I understand what you're saying is that you're being more mental, but the experience doesn't feel conceptual at all. It feels more fundamental than conceptual.
Yeah, partly we keep tripping up on this word conceptual. I don't think there's anything more fundamental than conceptual. Okay? But so I wouldn't disagree at all with how you describe that experience. Yeah? That's exactly how it happens, yeah? But what I'm trying to do is explain the mechanics that lie behind that. Okay? And that's not That's not, absolutely, it's not something which you think about or work out mentally any more than any kind of intuition is something you think about or work out mentally. Intuition is something that happens to you when you least expect it, yeah? It walks up behind you and whops you over the head, yeah? So it's not a matter of like working it out and it's not a matter of a logical process, right? A conscious logical process. It happens, as you say, through, but each time you're watching, and then suddenly the mind realizes, oh, okay, opens. And that can happen, of course, many times at many different levels, yeah? But what the mind is doing there is the mind is at a very, that kind of intuition is a generalization at a very deep level.
Yes.
Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah?
I'll go
yeah?
I guess with the breath, you know, if you're doing breath meditation for a long time, after 20 years or something, then, you know, you've seen it coming and going so many times, and then you remember, those breaths before they were impermanent, and I can experience that these are impermanent, and therefore from that inference you can generalize that the whole breath, the whole time, or at all times is impermanent, and then you can move from there and say, well, this as well is impermanent and subject to change, and everything is impermanent and subject to change.
Yeah.
But it's only through, because like you said, you can't experience
every single breath, So that can be done, you can do it as a conscious process, like you're describing. You can actually deliberately recollect it and reflect on it like that. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. But when it happens at a deep level, then it's not, you're not consciously saying those things, but it just, poof, there it is. Yeah. And so that's seeing what this is talking about, the dhammatittata, yeah, is the regularity of it. Yeah? Regularity of
the regularity of things being permanent.
Yeah. Okay. So it's good. Right. Back to the sutta. Okay. Now this is how. And Satchika replies by saying, "Dusutang, bad heard. Wata bho. Wata. Oh, that was really hard to hear that. Asadiya sumha." Yeah, my young Evang Lading. Okay, so what we've heard from the Venerable Gotama is disagreeable. Perhaps sometime or other. Apeva nama mayampi. Okay, apeva nama. Perhaps, maybe, sometime. Kadachi karahachi. Sometime or other. Okay, so another nice idiom. Kadachi karahachi. With that, Venerable Gotama, Master Gotama, we might have some conversation with him, perhaps. We might detach him from that evil view. Apeva nama tasma. Okay, apeva nama. Again, perhaps tasma papaka dithigata is the ablative from that view. Viveche yama. Okay.
Do you think that he's doing this, he's saying this because of the view of non-self?
Yeah. Now, just to come back to the previous one, because we haven't talked about what the five aggregates are. Now, the interesting thing about this and many similar contexts is that the five aggregates are just spoken of as if everybody knows what they are. He just comes along and says, well, the five aggregates. What's controversial is your attitude towards them, how you see them, how you understand them, but not actually what they mean, what they are. Okay? And so this is what leads me to suspect that the five aggregates is actually quite a common pre-Buddhist categories or ways of understanding the world. And particularly, I think, my suspicion is that they were originally a way of classifying self-theories, okay? And we find in the Brahmajala Sutta and other places, people say, you know, many theories there, for example, people say rupi atta, rupi being, you know, the self is possessed of form. Where's my thingy gone? Myself is possessed of form, rupi atta. Or they say ekanta sukha parisangredi atta, myself experiences exclusively bliss. Or they have the different kinds of devas with the different kinds of sanya, okay, and so on and so forth. So my feeling is that these were originally classes of views or types of views about self, which were collected into this kind of convenient scheme, which could then be used to identify different philosophical systems in terms of what kind of self that they posited. And the Buddha's innovation, of course, was to say that there's no self in there at all. Having said that, I haven't actually been able to find a mention of the five aggregates in any pre-Buddhist or non-Buddhist scriptures from the time. But here we go. But certainly, and again, we see quite asserted by Sachiko a bit later on. Now, that time, 500 lichavis. Okay, so the lichavis are the
decadent ones.
The decadent. Like
white horses with blue trim and the carriages which match. White trim.
White trim.
They also went out to Amber Pali as well.
Yeah. They were the upper class family in Vesali, okay? The clan, a bit like the Sakyans were in the Kapilavatthu. The decline of the Vajjian Republic is sometimes attested to their fun-loving ways as opposed to the more rigorous martial ways of the their Magadhan neighbours to the south. So, Abhikkhamattu Bhonto Lichavi, come out! Venerable Lichavis, come out. Today there will be some conversation between me and the recluse Gotama. If the recluse Gotama maintains before me what was maintained before me now by one of his famous disciples, the bhikkhu named Asaji, then, just as a strong man might seize a long-haired ram by the hair and drag him to and drag him fro and drag him round about, so, in debate, I will drag the recluse Gotama too, and drag him fro, and drag him round about, just as a strong brewer's workman might throw a big brewer's sieve into a deep water tank, and taking it by the corners, drag it to, and drag it fro, and drag it round about. So too, in debate, I will drag the recluse Gotama too, and drag him fro, and drag him round about. Just as a strong brewer's mixer might take a strainer by the corners and shake it down and shake it up and thump it about, so in debate I will shake the recluse Gotama down and shake him up and thump him about. Just as a 60-year-old, this guy seems to be somewhat fond of his own voice, just as a 60-year-old elephant might plunge into a deep pond and enjoy the game of hemp washing, so I shall enjoy playing the game of hemp washing with the recluse Gotama. Come out, good Lichavis, come forth. Today there will be some conversation between myself and the Reverend Gotama. So according to the commentary, men play the game of hemp washing when preparing hemp cloth. They bind up handfuls of rough hemp, immerse them in the water, and beat them on planks to the left, right, and middle. A royal elephant saw this game, and plunging into the water, he took up water in his trunk and sprayed it on his belly, his body, both sides, and his groin. Okay, so here's the sana dhovikang, is the hemp washing. Sana being the word for hemp or marijuana. Sana dhovikang. And in all of this, some grammatical remarks. You sort of always verbs. You have the waxing syllables principle at work. We haven't noticed our waxing syllable principles for a while. Akadhisami, parikadhisami, samparikadhisami. So a very obvious 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 syllables. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 syllables. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 syllables. Hey. Okay. So the waxing syllables principle at work, and also we can see the basic grammar here. So evmeva ahang, so this is nominative, I, okay? Samanang Gotamang in accusative will drag him to and drag him fro and drag him about. So this is the verb, and this ami ending is first person present tense, okay? Just as we had the ati is the third person down here. Ati is the third person present tense, and the army. Okay. So, obviously they're all looking forward to, they've got to have some kind of fun. They didn't have, you know, Xbox and stuff in those days. Thereupon, some Lichavi said, who is the recluse Gotama that he should refute Sachika the Niganta's son's assertion? On the contrary, Sachika the Niganta's son will refute the recluse Gotama's assertions. And some Lichavi said, who is Sachika the Niganta's son that he could refute the Blessed One's assertions? On the contrary, the Blessed One will refute Sachika the Niganta's son's assertions. So the Lichavis being divided in their loyalties, as one would expect. The Buddha had a lot of disciples there, but also the Nigantas had a lot of disciples there. Then Sachika the Niganta's son went with 500 Lichavis to the hall with the peaked roof in the great wood. Okay? And this, of course, being a famous location for many events in the Vinaya. yeah, obviously Venerable Tapasi's been especially researching all the naughty bits in Avinya, which is excusable since there's little else. Kutagara Sala, the pointed sala, okay, Kutagara is the pointed garage, Kuta is the point. Okay, and in that case there were many bhikkhus doing walking meditation in the open.
There's not very many mentions in the canon about walking meditation. There's a few here and there, but not so many.
Yeah. If the Jains came to visit our monastery, would they find the many bhikkhus doing walking meditation? No wonder. Anyway. And then Satchika Nigantaputta approached the bhikkhus and said to those bhikkhus, Kahang, where now is the Venerable or the Mr. Gotama? I wish to see him in Dasana Kama, okay, the Venerable Gotama. Esagi Vesana Bhagava, he's staying in the Great Wood. He's entered the Great Wood and is seated at the root of a tree for his day's abiding, Divaviharam. Okay. Then, the Satchika Nigantaputta, together with the great company, Parisa of Lichavis, went into the great wood, Mahavana, to found where the Buddha is, and having approached the Buddha, they exchanged the greetings and so on, and sat down to one side. And now, some of those Lichavis, this bit I think I've cut out of the printed version, those Lichavis, some of them, having paid respects to the Buddha, sat down to one side. Some of them, having exchanged cordial greetings with the Buddha, sat down to one side. Some of them, having made anjali to the Buddha, sat down to one side, and some of them, having in the Buddha's presence announced their name and clan, Nama Gotang, sat down to one side, and others, being silent, sat down to one side. Okay, so all representing different kind of attitudes towards the Buddha, different degrees of respect that they held to the Buddha. Ekamanta, so sitting down to one side, Satchika Nigantaputta said to the Blessed One, I would like to ask the Blessed One a question about something. Kanchi Deva Desang, okay, Desang, a point. So the word we have as in Desana, okay, is a teaching, okay. The basic meaning of Desana is from the root dis, meaning direction, okay. So we say the north, south, east, and west is a disa, it's a pointing out, yeah. So you point out, there's like a compass points, yeah, to a particular direction. So a Desana is a pointing out of things. And this is one point to which he's asking for the answer to, if the Blessed One gives me the leave to answer my question. And the answer, which is the lion's roar of the Buddha, okay? Very simple, but he says, ask, Ajgivesana, Yarakan Kasiti, whatever you want. Yeah? So this is very subtle, but this is the lion's. This is the lion's roar of the Buddha, yeah? His confidence. Ask anything you want. And then, of course, he repeats his question he asked before. How do you lead your disciples? And then he repeats the answer given earlier by Asaji. This is how I lead my disciples. Okay? Interestingly, in the Sanyutta version, rather than the Buddha just spontaneously coming out with the same answer that Asaji gave, in the Sanyutta version, Satchika tells the Buddha what Asaji had said, and then the Buddha agrees that that is in fact his disciple. So his teaching. So Satchika said, a simile, an upama, okay? So an upama, a bringing close to. So an upama, something you're bringing close to, holding two things together. It occurs to me, patibhāti, we discussed this the other day, patibhāna, I'm inspired with this thing. And the Buddha says, patibhātu tang agivesana. So this idiom captures the difficulty in expressing patibhāna. When Satchika said it, it sounds like it means, I feel inspired with this simile, it's something that's spontaneously arisen to me, it's like a mental thing. But what the Buddha's saying is, tell me what it is. Yeah? So it kind of it bridges that gap between what you feel inspired to say and what you actually come out with. Okay? And the reason why that is so is because it originally comes from the idea of poetry, where a poet will like spontaneously like be overcome. And in the ancient world, the poetry was often said to be like inspired by the gods, yeah? And so you overcome and you just speak from your own inspiration, yeah? And so that gap between what you think or what you want to say and what actually comes out is not there, yeah? Because you're being spoken through, in a sense, yeah? So, and this is, I think I mentioned before, Socrates, did I talk about that? Socrates' theory on poetry? Oh, his theory on poetry was that he reckoned that all poets, none of them knew what they were doing because they were all inspired by the gods. And every time he asked poets to explain their work, they all gave him the most hopeless answers. And everybody else was more capable of explaining what the poetry was than the poets themselves. That's proving that the only possible explanation is that it was inspired by the gods.
They were drunk on time.
Which I think is very perceptive. Okay, similarly, just as when seeds and plants, whatever their kind, reach growth, increase and maturation, all do so in dependence on the earth, based on the earth. And just as when strenuous works, whatever their kind are done, all are done in dependence on the earth and based on the earth. So too, Master Gotama, a person has material form as self, and based upon material form he produces merit or demerit. A person has feeling as self, and based upon feeling he produces merit or demerit. A person has perception as self, has formations, or sankharas as self, and has consciousness as self. And based on these things, he produces merit or demerit. Okay, so here we have an interesting formulation of a self theory. So notice, first of all, that Satchika, as I suggested earlier, is actually explicitly formulating his self theory in terms of the five aggregates. Okay, so he's affirming that the five aggregates are in fact the self. Rupa dayang, okay, the form is the self. Purisa pungalo. So a person, rupe patitaya, planted in material form, okay, so it's the same word that was used here for the earth, planted in the earth, patitaya, okay. And, sorry?
Pungalo items.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe, did they get something from the sounds in the, you see this? This Purisa Pungala. This person has Rupa as himself.
Yeah. I'm not sure, because they said that the Pugala is different from the five Khandas. Yeah.
And an interesting question that comes up here then, well, is it, there's no self, but who is it that experiences the, like that question is put forth, who is it that experiences the results of painful and pleasant results?
Mm-hmm.
Who is it that experiences that? And where are they stored, I guess? And how do they come to fruition?
Mm.
If there is no self, then where does, how can you, could you say that merit or demerit is stored as such?
Isn't that what do you call it when you have an assumption? Who is it? That's straight away, that's the assumption, then everything else starts to become irrelevant after that point.
What I meant to say is that, how does the process happen then?
How does the process happen?
How does the ripening of good and bad karma happen then? In this case, he's talking about merit and demerit.
Mm.
Then based on these five things,
mm.
he does merit or demerit. So then, how does merit happen in the Buddhist context, and how does it ripen?
Well, that could go on for some time. But I mean,
because we can't say that there's a self involved with that.
No. But suffice to say that all the Buddhist schools, there's no explicit explanation of that in the suttas, and all the Buddhist schools worked out their own explanations. You know, it's the Bhavanga Chitta or it's the Alaya Vijnana or whatever it is, and that was also one of the motivations behind the Sarvastivadin doctrine as well. That they argue that past karma still exists because it can still, its effects can still be felt. And so all the schools had different answers to that question. Okay? Right. Isn't what you're saying that form is myself, feeling is myself, sanya is myself, sankhara is myself, consciousness is myself. So he's summarizing Satchika's theory. So, I mean, I shouldn't rush over Satchika's theory too quickly. There's a number of interesting points there. One is the way that he's using similes, right, to infer his theory from, yeah? So that's quite a good way to develop your theory. I mean, it's not just a kind of a blind belief, yeah? He's reflected on it, yeah? He's developed a kind of a way of thinking about it. And it's a way of thinking about it which is quite nice in a sense. You know, he's based it on the fact that, you know, we're all kind of grounded here on the earth. Yeah, and so it's an empirical thing. You know, you can see that actually everything that comes up, you know, we have fruit. It comes up. So merit is always said to be the fruit of things. So fruit always comes up dependence on something, not independent. Yeah, obviously we're dependent on the earth, and the earth is, you know, seems like it's something stable and permanent. Yeah, when, you know, so this is one of the arguments we've seen earlier. The Buddha said that actually the earth isn't permanent. Okay. So don't you think this is what you're saying? All of these things are self. And he agrees. Satchika agrees. Yes, this is exactly what I'm saying. Form as myself, feelings myself, perceptions myself, sankara as myself, consciousness of myself, and so do all of these people here. Right? So this is, you see this kind of character of Satchika, you know, this kind of grandiosity about his character, you know. He's sort of gone with this big boasting in front of all the people, and that, and he's come along and said, yes, and all these people here agree with me. And the Buddha's saying, well, I don't care what all of those people agree with you or not, you know, just stay with your own. Yeah, curiosity. Inga tuang, bhagyavesana, sakam yeva, your own, sakam yeva. Just stick with your own stuff, with your own assertion, okay? And this is what we can have a discussion on the basis of. So you can see this is, of course, a classic rhetorical kind of device, you know? What I'm saying is right because so many people agree with me. And it was like this thing in this article on the structure of the universe is mathematics. It was in The New Scientist. And, you know, one of the arguments, it starts out by saying, in that article, it starts out by saying, well, let's assume that the physical world really exists in an objective sense. And because most scientists think believe that that's the way it is. Well, who cares what most scientists believe, actually? It's got nothing to do with whether the world really does exist out there. So it's the same argument used.
It's also a way of distancing yourself should any faults appear in your argument. You go, oh, yeah, but, you know, Joe Bloggs in the garage over there, he thinks that. I see this as a way of trying to have wriggle room to get away from something if the argument proves to go a bit poor later on.
Yeah, it could be.
I think the Buddha's response is very good here. It says, what is the great multitude to do with you? Just confirm what you have to say. That's if we're coming along with what we think, and then in discussion we shouldn't try and make our argument seem something better by saying
so many people agree with
also them. Say this.
Absolutely.
It's actually what we say is on their as saying for them on their behalf may not be actually what they're saying. And actually we should just say, this is what I think, rather than this is what everyone thinks.
Yep.
Like if we were to say, well, all Buddhists believe in karma and rebirth, then we would be wrong because there are some so-called Buddhists who believe that there is no karma and rebirth. So we should say, well, I believe rather than bring other people into argument.
So it's interesting, this is, you know, showing some of the debating techniques that were around at the time, yeah? And of course became a very sophisticated science in later years. Okay. Then I will answer your question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Agivesana? Would a head-anointed noble king, okay, for example, King Pasenadi of Kosala, or King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha, okay? And these, of course, being the two great kings, great kingdoms in that time. The head-anointed noble king exercised the power in his own realm. Sakasming vijite vaso. Okay? To execute those who should be executed. Ghate tayang. Ghate tung. To fine those who should be fined. Japate yayang. Vajape tung. And to expel those who should be banished. Pabajetayang wa pabajetung. So the word pabaja we use for to ordain, the going forth, is also used to here as a causative form to expel and to banish from a place. Okay. And then Satchika's answer again, sort of displaying this kind of grandiose tendencies that he had. Master Gotama, a head anointed noble king, for example, King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha, would exercise the power in his own realm to execute those who would be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to banish those who should be banished. For even these oligarchic communities and societies such as the Vajjians and Malians, okay, So these are examples of the oligarchical or semi-democratic communities, the Mallas and the Vajjis.
Where's Malla?
Malla is just, Malla's where the Buddha died in the Mallan Republic. So it's just next door to the Vajji and to Vaisali. They're kind of in an alliance with the Vajjis. Would exercise the power in their own realm to execute those who should be executed, fine those who should be fined, and to banish those who should be banished. So all the more so should a head-anointed noble king, such as King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha, he would exercise it, Master Gotama, and he would be worthy to exercise it. Okay? And so this is shows some interesting aspects of the political situation at the time, not only showing that there's a perceived difference between the more democratic communities, that somehow they're perhaps seen as less likely to exercise that kind of force, yeah, and that the king is the one who's going to be really the wielder of power, yeah. And of course, the assumption of capital punishment was, of course, practiced in those days. It was abolished by King Ashoka, and this was something which was contested among scholars up until I think Norman, if I'm not wrong, either Norman or Gombrich wrote an article about it. And there's a particular reading of a particular inscription, one of the Ashokan edicts, where he says that he's abolished capital punishment. And once the reading of that's been settled, it's now seems very likely that he did in fact abolish capital punishment. And so Satchika kind of expanding this thing, and particularly interesting is this little bit at the end, that he would be worthy to. Now, worthy here is arahant. The M is just a sandhi consonant, so just disregard that. I don't even think it should be, you know, whatever. But anyway, that doesn't really belong there. The word here is arahati, which is just the verb form from arahant, okay? And he would be worthy to perform it. But you could also translate as that as he has a right to do so, yeah? He has a right to do so. And so this word arahat is actually the closest word in Pali to the word we use when we say you have a right to do something. Okay? And the word, the language of rights is not used as such in Buddhism and Buddhist ethics, but this is the closest that it gets to say to the way that we words for rights are used.
You can say, I'm worthy to make that decision, or you can say, well, I have the right to.
I have a right to make a decision. Yeah, very close, yeah? Very close. And notice, of course, that the Buddha's statement is ethically neutral. He's not saying whether it's right for them to be doing capital punishment or expelling them or anything like that. He's merely saying that they do have the power. It's just an example he's using. So he's not making an ethical judgment, whereas Satchika feels the need to impose his own opinions on the matter. So it's very, very much you get the feeling of a personality behind these statements of Satchika.
You can't another put the truth in then if he asserts that doctrine.
Yeah, that's problematic, isn't it? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's not of course, unfortunately, most Buddhist countries have kept up with capital punishment, even today. Very sad. And when a certain monk spoke out against it, he was criticized by the Sangha. Yeah, this thing a couple of years ago, I was in Singapore, and there was this Vietnamese fellow was Australian Vietnamese. Oh, this is such a sad story. He had his brother who was, you know, got in debt or something like that, and he kind of got forced into this thing, and he was carrying some drugs and carried them through Singapore, got arrested and was going to be executed. And I was in Singapore at the time, and somebody's emails got sent around saying, oh yeah, you're discussing the ethical issues of it, and somebody said, you know, the Sydney kind of people, and somebody, I don't know who it was, said, oh yeah, I'm sure Bhante Sujato would agree that it's right to execute drug dealers. So I got sent this email from Kim saying, Bhante, would you like to comment on this? You're bloody right, I'd like to comment on this. So I sort of made this response and sent it off and asked it to be circulated around, and it was then kind of raised in the Sangha meeting or at the Sangha in Thailand, that I shouldn't have been making statements like that, because
teaching Dharma is done.
Yeah, teaching people, teaching harmlessness and anyway, there you go. So I shouldn't have been endangering the possibility of the Sangha getting their Singapore visas was the issue that they were concerned about. By criticizing the criticising the Singapore government. I don't think the Singapore government really was particularly worried about me.
Sometimes feel disgusted to be part of the Sangha like that?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that he says that he doesn't condone killing, nor does he speaks in the praise of non-killing?
Yeah, of course. Anyway.
Well, thanks for speaking up, Ante. Yeah. Right view.
Right. You would exercise it. What do you think? When you say thus, material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over that material form as to say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? When this was said, Satchika, the Niganta's son, was silent. Okay? So notice here also the way the argument's being developed is using a simile. Okay? But the Buddha's method is a little bit different to Satchika's method. Satchika announces his simile and then draws the conclusion, okay, and sort of presents that to the Buddha. The Buddha uses what's much closer to the Socratic method of getting an agreement from the person first. Yeah? Yeah? Get them to agree with what they're going to agree with. Oh, do you think that's all right? Yeah, sure. And then lead them on to the next bit. And this, of course, is absolute fundamental. It's all that Socrates did. His whole life was to get people to agree to things and then show them that what they agreed to was either completely silly or contradicted what they said elsewhere or whatever. And unfortunately, Socrates didn't have the same kind of security protection that the Buddha seems to have enjoyed in this particular sutta. So that's why he got had to drink the hemlock. So, when this was said, Satchika Niganta Putta, Donhi Ahosi. Oh dear. Second time he said that. Second time he was Donhi Ahosi. And third, then he said, okay, now answer. Alright. Now is not the time to be silent. Okay. Nadani te Donhi Bhava Sakalo. If anyone, when asked a reasonable question, okay, sahadhamikang, okay, sahadhamikang putto, by the Tathagata still does not answer, then there and then his head splits into seven pieces.
I wondered about that.
Did you? Really? Regarding this, there is the following anecdote. Brahmadatta, the great grandson of Chikitana, while drinking King Soma, said, "Ooh, let this Soma strike off my head if I say that the Ayasya Angirasa chanted the Udgita through any other means than this vital breath and speech. Surely he chanted through speech and the vital breath." This is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which was probably a couple of hundred years before the Buddha. He is Gargi in debate with Yajnavalkya. Then Gargi, the daughter of Vachaknu, questioned him. Yajnavalkya, said she, this is like at the end of this whole debate. All of these other Brahmins have debated Yajnavalkya and been defeated. Now Gargi steps up to the thing. Right. If all this is pervaded by water, by what is water pervaded? By air, O Gargi. And by what, pray, is air pervaded? By the sky. And what is the sky pervaded by the world of Gandharvas? And what is the world of Gandharvas pervaded by the sun? And then by the moon, and then by the gods, and then by the world of Indra, by the world of Viraj, whatever that is, by the world of Hiranyagarbha. And then this is like the golden egg, Hiranyagarbha. By what, pray, is the world of Hiranyagarbha pervaded? Do not, O Gargi, question too much, lest your head should fall off. You are questioning too much about a deity about whom we should not ask too much. Do not ask too much, O Gargi. Okay.
So maybe this is a reading back into the sutta that's come later from someone from a Brahmanical background.
Well, certainly some basis, some tradition about it. Here's another discourse with Yajnavalkya, and he says, Yajnavalkya, if you take away these cows, right, because he's giving a debate, he's going to win the cows, right? If you do not know that sutra, that thread, and that inner controller, the Antaryami, and still take away the cows that belong only to the knowers of Brahman, your head will fall off. I know, O Gotama, that sutra and that inner controller. Anyone might say, well, I know, but what actually do you know? So he then goes on to tell it. Okay.
This is still Upanishad.
Still the same Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Keeps on going. And Yajnavalkya is now debating with who? Sakalya. In what do the body and the heart find their support? In the prana. What does the prana find its support in the apana, the vyana, and the udana, or some all different kinds of breaths? Here the Upanishad itself states, that self is that which has been described as not this, not this. Neti, neti. It is imperceptible, for it is never perceived. Undecaying, for it never decays. Unattached, for it is never attached. Unfettered, for it never feels pain and never suffers injury. Yajnavalkya said, these are the eight abodes, the eight organs of vision, the eight deities and the eight beings. Now I ask you about that person who is to be known only from the Upanishads, who definitely projects those beings and again withdraws them into himself, and who is at the same time transcendental. If you cannot clearly explain him to me, your head shall fall off. Right? So this is Yajnavalkya talking to Sakalya. Sakalya did not know him. His head fell off. And robbers snatched away his bones, mistaking them for something else. Right? So this is a bit like the, what is your name? he said, fell off. So, not only do we have the precedent for saying your head's going to fall, heads are going to roll, right? We still say it today, don't we? Yeah? If we've done some improvement, heads are going to roll, yeah? Still used as a threat today, but it seems his head did fell off. What can I say?
Via a sword or something? Or?
But in the Buddhist context, no one's head does fall off in this case.
Yeah, no, the Buddhism's much much more nice. So, obviously, you know, this whole kind of deep cultural context, you know, Satchika is arguing from the Nigantas, he's talking about the self and all these kinds of things, and then this, a thunderbolt wielding spirit holding an iron thunderbolt. Yaka, yeah. Yaka's identified with Indra. Vajrapani, okay, holding, and so this is of course very famous in Tibetan tradition, they have Vajrapani. Yaka. Holding an iron vajra, saying aditang, sampajalitang, sajoti bhutang, blazing, burning and glowing. And he appeared in the air above Satchika the Niganta Sun, thinking, if this Satchika the Niganta Sun, when asked a reasonable question up to the third time by the Blessed One, still does not answer, I shall split his head into seven pieces here and now. The Blessed One saw the thunderbolt-wielding spirit, and so did Satchika the Niganta's son. Then Satchika the Niganta's son was frightened, alarmed, and terrified, understandably so. I would be too. I'll just share something with you there.
So okay. This indicates he had psychic powers?
No, just the Yaka was appearing to him, that's all.
And the rest of the 500?
Oh, it's up to the Yaka who he wants to appear to. Don't ask too many questions, all right? Seeking his shelter, asylum and refuge in the Blessed One himself, he said, ask me, Master Gotama, I shall answer. Okay, so Nigantamato, Bhito, terrified, Sangvigo. Okay, he's Sangvegat, he's roused up. Loma Hattajato, his Loma is all standing up. Okay, ask, I will answer. What do you think? When you say, material form is myself. Can you wield the power of the material form as to say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? Of course, this is like the inverse of the first section in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, okay, about the controllability of the aggregates. He says, no hidang bho Gotama, okay. No hidang. Manasikarohi, pay attention. Manasikaritva, you should explain. Na kote sandhiyati. What you said before doesn't agree with what you said afterward. They don't connect. Okay. and same for all the aggregates. Then he goes through the material form, is it permanent and impermanent and so on. The same again as in the Anathalakana Sutta, and Ichang and so on. And when one adheres to suffering, dukkhang alino, dukkhang upagato, when one resorts to suffering, holds to suffering, adhoti sito, and then says, suffering is myself, I am, then can one oneself, can one oneself fully understand suffering or abide with suffering utterly destroyed? And then Agivesana, Satchika says, how could that be, Master Gotama? No, Master Gotama. Okay? This also seems to contradict the question we asked before about why is dukkha not mentioned? We have anicca and anatta, why is dukkha not mentioned? If dukkha was not an appropriate topic of conversation with Satchika, why is it being quite strongly emphasized here?
Maybe anicca implies dukkha.
Anicca implies dukkha, yeah. Okay. And so, another similarly, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, were to take a sharp axe and enter the wood. And there he would see a large plantain tree, straight, young, with no fruit bud core. Then he would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the leaf sheaths. But as he went on unrolling the leaf sheaths, he would never come even to any sapwood, let alone heartwood. So too, Agivesana, when you are pressed, questioned and cross-questioned by me about your own assertion, you turn out to be empty, vacant, and mistaken. But it was you who made this statement before the Vaisali assembly. I see no recluse or Brahmin who would not shake, shiver, tremble, and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in debate with me. Now, there are drops of sweat on your forehead, and they have soaked through your upper robe and fallen to the ground, but there is no sweat on my body now. And the Blessed One uncovered his golden-coloured body before the assembly. So he says, you've been questioned, your ritto tucho aparadho, empty, vacant. So then the Buddha... Yeah, look, he's
just rubbing it in.
Yeah, he's not okay, exposed his golden body to the audience.
What's gold here?
Suvarna. So the vana is the colour, yeah, and suvarna means colour, means good colour literally, but it's the word for gold. So suvarna varna, golden coloured, literally is good coloured coloured, but golden coloured. And where are we?
And vivari?
Vivari is to expose. Had that word in the other sutta we looked at from the Anguttara, and the Buddha explains and teaches and declares and so on, the Dhamma, and also vivarati. Yeah, he exposes it. Same word there. Yeah, vibhajati, analyzes it, makes it clear, vibhajati. Okay. And then he sat down, shoulders drooping, face down, brooding with nothing to say. Much like Mara did, of course. I was trying to look earlier, there's actually some representations in the Sanchi and Amaravati stupas of Mara actually sitting down like that, scratching the ground with a stick and so on. So I couldn't find a nice clear version of one. Okay. So what do you think? Is that cool to reduce him to a dribbling mess, sweating and stuff, and then to show off your own beautiful body as a way of winning the argument?
Yeah, really powerful.
I mean, he's covering every point that was raised by him in the first, this Nigata in the first place. He's not going overboard, he's just
responding to what he actually did.
Every single criterion raised.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point she comes on a stage where you have been able to let go of everything.
Mm.
Then you have nothing to fear anymore.
Mm.
Because there's nothing that you hold to anymore.
Mm.
So you can't fear losing anything.
Mm. Well, Satchika's obviously got a bit of self invested in the whole process, hasn't he?
So for someone enlightened, there's nothing to fear because there's nothing held to it.
Yeah.
There's no fear of losing it.
Yeah. So all three versions have the Buddha uncovering his body. Now then, sad face. Dumuko. Okay?
Sad mouth.
Sad face. Could be sad mouth, but probably sad face. According to the commentary, this is just his name. He, in fact, was very good looking.
Now,
he says, a simile occurs to me. Well, Zumuka, explain it to us. Suppose, venerable sir, not far from a village or town, there was a pond with a crab in it. And then a party of boys or girls went out from the town or village to the pond, went into the water, and pulled the crab out of the water and put it on dry land. They haven't changed much, have they? And whenever the crab extended a leg, they cut it off, broke it, and smashed it with sticks and stones, so the crab, with all its legs cut off, broken, and smashed, would be unable to get back into the pond as before. So too, all of Sachika, the Niganta's son's contortions, writhings, and vacillations have been cut off, broken, and smashed by the Blessed One, and now he cannot get near the Blessed One again for the purpose of debate. Okay? The visukayitani, visevitani, vipanditani, contortions, writhings, and vacillations. Great translation, sir.
It's interesting, in both the occasion of the yaka and this character, makes this inspired utterance that the Buddha's never the agent of "I told you so."
Yeah.
It's always somebody else, you know, like the fearful yaka appearing
there. Yeah,
yeah. You know, come on. Like heavy handed.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Good
PR.
Good cop, bad cop. When this was said, Sachika said to Dumukam, to Sad Face, the Lichibiputta, "Hang on a minute. Agamehi literally means come, but this is the idiom that's used in Pali to mean wait. Agamehi. Let that be. Let talk of ours and other ordinary recluses Brahmins. It was mere prattle, I think." Okay? So now he's just dismissing the whole kind of thing. This is vilapang, vilapitang, manye. Okay? Just prattle. In what way is a disciple of the Master Gotama one who carries out his instruction, responds to his advice, who has crossed beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation? So, of course, this is a little bit unusual, since it's a classical Buddhist description of a stream enterer. So perhaps this has been standardized to a Buddhist perspective, one would suspect. Yeah, probably just meant how it is how does a disciple contemplate? And so the Buddha says, any kind of material form whatsoever, past, present, future, sees them as not me, not mine, not myself. And yathabhutang samapanyaya pasati. So this is the key phrase here, that one sees them according with yathabhuta, accordance with truth, or however you want to say them, how as it has been produced, created, or whatever. Sees rightly with wisdom. Okay, so this is the Savaka, the stream enterer, who's crossed over doubt and all these kinds of things. So this is a description of the stream enterer. So notice this is quite important to see that this is how the stream enterer is described. Five khandhas is impermanent, not self, and so on. He sees them as in accordance with the truth. And then how is one an arahant? Okay, so we've talked about the stream enterer, now the arahant. What's the difference between the arahant and the stream enterer? And the key difference here is that the arahant, yathabhutang samapanyaya diswa, okay, having seen diswa, accordance with truth, with right wisdom, then anupada vimutto hoti, he is freed without grasping. Okay, so this is the difference. Both of them have seen the khandhas as not self, but the arahant, in addition, is rightly freed from all defilements. So there's like a twofold process, and this is portrayed quite consistently throughout the suttas, this difference. Then that bhikkhu whose mind has been freed is endowed with three unexcelled things, or three perfections: the unexcelled vision, unexcelled practice, and unexcelled release. Okay, and that bhikkhu then would worship, honor, and revere the Tathagata. Okay, and The Blessed One is tamed and teaches the Dhamma for taming oneself. He's at peace and teaches the Dhamma for the sake of peace. He has crossed over and he teaches the Dhamma for crossing over. The Blessed One has attained Nibbana and he teaches the Dhamma for attaining Nibbana. So again, probably a gentle rebuke to Satchika's aggressive and disrespectful attitude earlier. That's not how the Arahants would approach the Tathagata. And Satchika seems to agree because he says, Sri Gautama, we were bold and impudent. Dhangsi, bold and impudent. Bhagabha. This word is in the Metta Sutta, apagabho. Okay? Not impudent. Apagabha. And we should attack the Master Gautama in debate. A man might attack a mad elephant and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gautama and find safety. Interestingly enough, there's a ancient Jewish legend about how the Jewish people were attacked by a king resented them and wanted to destroy and wipe them out, and so he made a whole herd of elephants mad with liquor and attached weapons to them and tried to kill them in exactly the same way as happened with Devadatta. And interesting to wonder whether there's any connection between those two legends there. A man might attack a blazing mass of fire and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gautama and find safety. A man might attack a terrible poisonous snake and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gautama and find safety. We were bold and impudent in thinking we could attack Master Gautama in debate. Let the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me. The Blessed One consented in silence. So interesting that, you know, there's certainly some sincerity there. He realizes he's been beaten in the debate and says, all right, well, come for the tomorrow's dana. So then, knowing the Blessed One had consented, Satchika the Niganta son addressed the Lichavis. Hear me, Lichavis, the recluse Gautama, together with the Sangha of good Bhikkhus, has been invited by Sangha of good Bhikkhus. Bhikkhu Sanghena. Sangha, together with the Sangha of good Bhikkhus, something, it's an unusual phrase, it doesn't say anything here. It said, Svatanaya Bhatena Sandhing Bhikkhu Sanghena, unless Bhikkhu Bodhi had a different reading. This is together with the Bhikkhu Sangha. You may bring to me whatever you think would be suitable for him. Then when the night had ended, Lichavis brought 500 ceremonial dishes of milk, rice as gifts of food. Okay. Then Satchika, the Niganta's son, had good food of various kinds prepared in his own park and had the time announced to the Blessed One. It is time, the meal is ready. Then it being morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robes, he went with the Sangha of Bhikkhus to the park of Satchika, the Niganta's son, and sat down on the seat made ready. And then with his own hand, Satchika, the Niganta's son, served and satisfied the Sangha of Bhikkhus headed by the Buddha with the various kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten and put his bowl to one side, Satchika, the Niganta's son, took a low seat, sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gautama, may the merit and the great meritorious gifts of this act of giving be for the happiness of the givers. Okay. Agivesana, so replies the Buddha, whatever comes from giving to a recipient such as yourself, who is not free from greed, hatred, and delusion, that will be for the givers. And whatever comes about from giving to a recipient such as myself, one who is free from greed, hatred, and delusion, that will be for you. So it's a very kind of interesting response here. The,
it's a mirror and parallel to the previous statement about not bringing other people into the argument. It's
uh-huh.
It's almost like a direct parallel.
Oh, yeah, 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 it's interesting. Yeah.
He's saying, oh, everybody thinks this way. Or...
Yeah, 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 yeah. He's trying to get everyone involved. Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. That's probably why it's there. Now, in the Sanyutta version, it has a similar statement, but in a different context. According to the Sanyutta, Agama, when the Buddha and the monks had left, at the end of the meal, the Buddha spoke some Anumodana verses to Satchika, and then afterwards, the Buddha and the monks left Satchika and were on their way back to the monastery. The monks were discussing who got the merit for the meal. Did the Lichavis, who provided the food, get the merit? Or did Satchika himself get it? They asked the Buddha, and then the Buddha gave the same answer. And the Yukotra Agama version is different again in that Satchika became a stream enterer after a gradual discourse at the end of the meal. Later on, according to that version, Satyaka's disciples, who had found out that their teacher had gone over to the Buddha, intercepted him when he was coming back from another visit to the Buddha and killed him. Right?
In a Mullah Savasti Vardhan version?
No, but I'm sure they would have liked it. Yeah.
Killed him with golden lotuses.
In evaluating these different presentations, the Sangyutta seems to better fit the Buddha's personality than the Pali account. Since according to the Pali account, Satyaka was considered by many to be a saint, the Buddha publicly highlighting Satyaka's lack of spiritual accomplishment must have appeared as insulting and offensive. One would not expect the Buddha to make such a statement when Satyaka had publicly admitted the foolishness of his earlier attempt to challenge the Buddha and had just provided the Buddha and the monks with a meal and was forming an aspiration to share the merit of the offering. By having the Buddha make this statement to the monks and not to Satyaka, the Sanyukta Agama version avoids presenting the Buddha in the almost resentful attitude attributed to him by the Pali version. Of the three versions, the Akhotra Agama version appears the least credible. Now, one problem with this presentation is that none of the discourses mention Satyaka to have had disciples, which should have been there during this important encounter with the Buddha. And even if he did have disciples, it seems to be going a little too far to have them kill their teacher merely because he became a follower of the Buddha. Okay, so it seems the Akhotra Agama version is perhaps not so convincing in this case. But I think the Sangyutta Agama version is quite nice. It was like a discussion afterwards. It's a bit similar to the Samanyapala Sutta, where Ajatasattu, sort of after he left, then the monks asked, you know, and the Buddha said the king's doomed. Yeah? But he didn't kind of insult him to his face. So this is the Chula Satyaka Sutta. So we get more of Satyaka with the next lesson, with the Maha Satyaka Sutta.
It was a nice story. The Buddha had a real sense of a story.
An event, yeah?
Yeah. With personality.
Yeah.
And I guess when someone comes to you and attacks you on some kind of doctrinal point, the Buddha's response is not one of defensiveness or attacking back. Cool, calm, and collected wave.
Responding.
No sweat coming from your body.
Not sweating it. Don't sweat it.
Is that where the expression "chill out" comes from?
Yeah, well, we still use the same thing. We still use the same thing. You know, they say don't sweat it. You know, don't sweat the big stuff.
We just don't bare our body things. Don't sweat.
Maybe it's a bit unfair, though, because the Buddha was just sitting quietly in meditation in the nice cool forest and Satyaka would have to walk out from the city, yeah?
He would have been sweating.
In the hot day. Okay, let's finish by paying respect.
Thank you.